All right, we are back, and now we're going to turn to the paper by Augstdorfer discussing the empirical phenomenon that he wants to make us aware of, namely bootlegging. Bootlegging describes this phenomenon that employees in R&D units develop innovations secretly. They do so in hiding, and they do so without formal permission. That means that R&D workers are going to be developing innovations that have not been approved or even have actively been rejected by the organization. They're going to be doing that even despite attempts to manage. Right? When somebody's trying to alert you to a discovered empirical phenomenon like this, there are a few sort of obvious questions that you want to have answered. Right? What is the extent of the occurrence of this? What are the effects? What is the result of the phenomenon? And what does it mean that it occurs in some contexts more than others? Before we get into those, before we get into answering those questions, it is worth focusing a little bit on an interesting objection that I sometimes hear, especially from engineers, about this concept. Namely, isn't this just obvious? Isn't it obvious that bootlegging would happen? We kind of touched upon this as we were talking about Shane's paper, that isn't it obvious that prior knowledge is going to matter for opportunity discovery? And in the same way, isn't it obvious that engineers, R&D workers, are going to be working on hidden projects? I have sort of a meek defense to make of that, in that everything is obvious once you've heard about it, right? How many of you were sitting, for instance, last lesson when we talked about variations of ambidexterity and considered the different things that would make contextual ambidexterity possible, right? Besides trust and learning, did you consider the fact that maybe the possibility that ideas could be pursued in secrecy would also be a way to make contextual ambidexterity possible? Some of you probably, but if you're like most innovation researchers, it probably wasn't entirely on your radar as a particularly important thing. It may have been an empirical opportunity. Sure, it's something that could happen. But maybe it was something that was going to be difficult to know about. And even if you could know about it, it would probably be sort of trivial. So why care about it, right? When the possibility of secrecy is not included in theoretical explanations, but ought to be included, the exercise is often that you kind of don't want to just throw everything at your explanation, right? Everyone knows that theories are simplifications. We can't understand the whole world, but we can kind of cut it down to size and see that there are lots of things that matter, but some matter more than others. And we basically want to focus on the ones that matter most. So instead of just saying, as Augstdorfer does, that the kind of conventional assumption in innovation research is that innovation should be under the direct control of management within the company, you could kind of imagine him saying that, well, maybe this explanation that he's advancing, this idea that secrecy really matters, would be kind of a nice way to say, well, it probably matters more than we have given it credit for. But that's sort of an aside. I think, for instance, he could have played more into Cooper's argument and saying, well, Cooper kind of makes this assumption that innovation is going to be under the direct control of management. That's fair, but maybe secrecy matters more than he gives it credit for. Right. Anyway, that's sort of an aside. I think there's sort of a better way to think about why this is not obvious, actually. As I said, all things are obvious once you know them, but until you know them, they're maybe not so obvious. And there is a really good explanation for why you should actually let Augstdorfer's argument surprise you a little bit. If you want to think back to March and his idea about exploration and exploitation, he essentially made the point that they are competing for scarce resources. So it's actually a little bit of a defense for why Augstdorfer's argument is not obvious. Irrespective of whether you're exploring or exploiting, you would actually assume that innovations, in order to be developed, need resources. They can't be developed without resources. But the point in bootlegging when you're doing something that is not managerially approved, you supposedly don't get resources, right? So you're not actually in competition with other innovation activities about scarce resources. And that's sort of interesting, both that this can happen and that there seems to be some margin in which innovation could be done without allocation of resources. So in this sense, maybe we're dealing with another way that the trade-off between exploration and exploitation could be seen as a misrepresentation of reality. We sort of discussed that in last lesson. But basically, you could say that framing the balance between exploration and exploitation as a trade-off doesn't take into account the possibility that innovation can take place without investments. But anyway, let's get back to Augstorfer and what he has to tell us about bootlegging. Let's start with focusing on why bootlegging happens. Augstorfer is going to be drawing a lot on some of Marx's other work, something that's often associated with what's called the Carnegie School. One of the big ideas in that in his work is the idea of the garbage can decision making that you may encounter in other subjects. But basically, what he's referring to is this idea that sometimes problems arise, or rather that Let me start over, right? The idea of the garbage can decision-making is that often answers appear before the questions that they're addressing, right? Answers pop up, and so they look for a problem to solve, right? The same thing goes for ideas for innovations, right? They can occur without it being exactly clear how those innovations or the ideas would fit into the organization, into the strategy, into the kind of ideas about how the organization should be developing things. That is basically an idea that comes out of this this idea of the garbage can model of decision making, and that's something that is going to be inspiring to Augstorfer as he tries to explain bootlegging. Right. The second thing that he takes from the Carnegie School is the idea of slack innovation. That is, sometimes there are resources in the organization that aren't fully dedicated, that can be used for something else and that has some leeway in how they're applied. The Carnegie School, and March in particular, has kind of argued that that's pretty often the case. You often have those slack resources in the organization. And slack is something that can also actively be created, right? An R&D worker can be fully booked up during his working hours for formal projects. But maybe if he stays a little longer after the end of the workday, he might have room to work on a project that's more personal to him or her, right? So it's all about finding these untapped resources that organizations may or may not have more of, right? So the second question, so that's kind of the inputs, if you will. Right? What gets used when people engage in bootlegging? Right? They might be using ideas that haven't quite found a problem to solve, and they may be using these slack innovation, these slack resources. But the question is, why do they use those resources? Why do they use those ideas in particular ways? Right? And why do they engage in? Just saying that you have an idea that hasn't found a solution and that you're trying to use resources that haven't been fully dedicated, it doesn't really explain why you go about your innovation in a secret way. Why do you go through the effort of bootlegging and of hiding? Now, one of the things that he points out here is that organizations do a lot of things to try to reduce the uncertainty of innovation projects, right? That feeds directly back into Cooper's way of thinking. You might, to pass a certain gate, need a feasibility study, right? You might need to know what a project is going to do, what it's going to cost, and you can have all these sort of activities, possibly of a management accounting nature, that try to reduce uncertainty by allocating resources or other activities in sort of a very particular sort of way. In this way, you can kind of see secrecy and secret innovation projects as a natural response to the efforts of management to manage innovation, right? there may be so high requirements for passing a certain gate that it may be necessary to work on a project in secret in order to accumulate the kind of experience and documentation and uncertainty reduction that's necessary for it to formalize. And that kind of has an interesting implication, right? It may imply that more management actually makes innovation projects less manageable because they displace activities away from the space in which executives have insights on what's going on. Okay? The interesting thing about this explanation is that it draws kind of an interesting picture of what gatekeepers understand and of why they make decisions in the way they do. Right? The idea of a stage gate system is that there are gatekeepers who make informed decisions about what should proceed and what should not. But it also creates the need for innovators, the ones who are having their ideas evaluated, to do all kinds of activities to demonstrate the technical feasibility of their solution. That might mean that if innovators are skilled at innovating and not at demonstrating feasibility, too many projects might actually get sorted out. They might be rejected as technically unacceptable. Executives may be making decisions with too limited prior knowledge, right? Alternatively, we might imagine that leaders might actually know these things and that they are speculating in the possibility that R&D workers will keep working on projects in their off hours, in their slack, in the time that is slack, and try to accumulate experience so that they can return with a more developed and more well-functioning solution, right? In that way, forcing people directly or indirectly into bootlegging may be a way for them to develop innovations in a way that is less resource-consuming and more scrappy. This speaks to kind of the very different ways that leaders can relate to bootlegging, and Augstorfer comes up with a number of generic relationships, right? He talks about the schizophrenic relationship where leaders formally reject bootlegging but informally accept it. You can imagine them just closing their eyes to it. This type of double standard is not uncommonly documented in organization research, and it appears more often than you would think because it's really the only way in which organizations can function when they're exposed to conflicting demands. One conflicting demand, of course, being to be both innovative and efficient. Of course, there's also the model where everyone sort of formally agrees that bootlegging is an effective tool that's good for R&D employees, and that it can increase their productivity and creativity to interact with their own self, with their own self-defined, interest-driven projects, because it may be difficult to control, but it's still kind of a valuable contribution to the innovation project. This, in sort of important ways, contradicts what Cooper is saying, that projects should be managed. And it could have essentially a number of positive effects to not manage them so much. For instance, you could just see the engagement in bootlegging as a way to build up absorptive capacity in the way that people constantly work on things that are on the edge of what the organization is formally dedicated to and what is strategically focusing on. That might be a way to build in a high level of readiness and a higher level of prior knowledge in Cohen and Leventhal's sense. The other angle might be that there is that if you think of bootlegging as sort of an employee benefit, something that can satisfy R&D workers' scientific curiosity, it can be something that is just a valuable part of the working package for people, right? There is some literature about the management of R&D workers that suggests that being able to indulge that curiosity is a really valuable asset for this employee group. There are a bunch of further things that you can kind of dig into on the idea of bootlegging. I'm not going to spend that much time on it. Augstorfer's book, 1996, is when it came out, and the book is called Forbidden Fruit. It does quite a good job of explaining the empirical extent of bootlegging, and it seems basically in many places it happens, but there are few employees who do it, and they spend quite a limited amount of time on it. You can also read a very good paper that he has about bootlegging and path dependence from 2007. It was published in Research Policy, where he basically argues that many of the projects that get carried out as bootlegging activities are really quite close to the company's other activities. So they're guided quite a lot by what the organization already does. And thus, it's typically just a way that you can reduce the uncertainty of a project up front. In that sense, it's a relatively harmless sort of activity to integrate into the organization's operations. In that sense, you would actually see that bootlegging supposedly doesn't contribute so much to absorptive capacity because it's essentially very close to what the organization already does. The most important thing to me, at least, and the most interesting thing is that it paints a sort of particular picture of R&D projects as reactive, as something that responds to management and input in a way that is not entirely passive and not entirely predictable, right? The people who are involved in particular projects, they will anticipate and predict the way the projects will be evaluated, I think, and they will adjust their innovation efforts around it. They may work hidden for longer or shorter periods. And if they find that their ideas are rejected, they may find ways to continue their work anyway. They act when others act upon them. I think that probably is the right way to understand innovation projects and organizations generally, and that's how I encourage you to understand them, as something where many players are involved, each with their own agendas, and they are constantly interacting, both formally but also informally, and have all kinds of leeway and all kinds of discretion in which to pursue their projects, right? Actors aren't just docile and passive recipients of management directives and decisions. And while you can kind of at the aggregate level see innovation projects as a result of managerial plans and decisions, that understanding will tend to collapse when you go into the empirical reality of what people actually do as they're doing innovation projects. Innovation in that sense becomes much more emergent and mutable as something that emerges out of the many, many different actors and their many different intentions and plans and actions. Right. So with that, I am going to close for today. I look forward to seeing you in class. Enjoy your further preparations.